engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
And good morning, and welcome to another edition of Guardian AM Radio. And this is CA Nuri, and I'm holding on. I am holding on once more again for 3 days of holding on, right? And I want to say that if you tremble and shake with the indignation of injustice every time, you are definitely a comrade of mine. So I want to claim that, but that doesn't belong to me. That belongs to another talk show host, I think one. But that sounded so profound that I wanted to claim it. But if I can continue this, I need someone to send in something I can say before things start. Today I have an interesting show. I have an interesting show where I invited someone who I'm a fan of. Now, mind you, I must say that he's my second choice, but that doesn't mean he's less special. And the reason why I invited him on, because I am vexed. I actually am vexed about something. And this something has something to do with something that trended and went viral the other day. Right? I'm going to play that first clip. And you can see that you will get the same type of excitement that I got. And the reason why I got vexed is because I did not know this. And I'm like saying, who is hiding my history? Who is taking advantage of me not knowing who I is? Someone is sinister. Someone is trying to defame me and make me less Bahamian. And that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about who is this sinister person that is hiding my history, my culture, who I am from me. And that's why I brought my special guest, because I think he is responsible. He is responsible for me not knowing myself. So play that clip right there.
In the country's history, there's been some interesting and peculiar moments in which the Bahamas became a geopolitical space for freedom. One of those moments was in 1841 when you have the incident called the Creole, where you have a ship that is destined for New Orleans with enslaved persons, that it's going to eventually have a mutiny occur, led by Madison Washington and others. They were over 130 enslaved.
That was by Chris Curry and Dr. Chris Curry, right? And that could have continued playing. But if you want to put on the first clip, I could play that, and I'll play Curry right afterwards. We have two clips right back to it. The first clip, so we can understand why Curry responded that. I had an interview with Dr. Curry, and the preclude is what he responded to.
We've all heard of the Underground Railroad, but what if I told you there was another Underground Railroad that you were never taught in school? The Saltwater Railroad was a series of secretive networks that allowed for African-American runaways to escape slavery and seek freedom in the nation of the Bahamas. This was especially the case for African-Americans living in the state of Florida. Prior to 1819, when Florida would officially be ceded to the United States, it was ruled by Spain. And in Florida, you had the Seminole people and you had runaway Africans who were fleeing states to South Carolina, Georgia, to freedom in Florida. The Seminole people also helped, but most importantly, you had what was called Fort Mosa. Now, Fort Mosa was the first legally sanctioned free Black community in the present day the United States, and there is an historical part there today. This is especially important to consider because look at the map. If you're an African-American in the Deep South, such as Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama, you don't have the means to go to the North. That's thousands of miles away, and you got to go through other slave states. So the likelihood of being caught was very likely. So therefore, the only option was to flee to the Caribbean. Now, during this time in the Bahamas in the 1830s, slavery was being abolished, and the Bahamas had a majority black population. It was notorious for being anti-slavery. Matter of fact, if you've ever heard of the ship, there was a ship called the Creole that revolted, and they were able to land the Bahamas. Matter of fact, this railroad was so effective that in the 1840s, there were over 6,000 African-Americans who had fled there, and it was getting on white Southern slave owners' nerves, and they even wanted to demand Britain to send the slaves back, but Britain refused. So Britain decided it was just going to pay compensation to those slaveholders. But beside that, there are still communities there today. One of them is the Gambier Historical Village, and you can get this on the islands of the Bahamas. And it's just outside of Nassau, and it's one of the oldest villages in New Provinces. And that was an example of runaway slaves, African Americans who fled. Another one was Adelaide Beach, which was another one in New Providence. Matter of fact, there are still stories of African American runaway slaves going to the Bahamas to this day. And as I've said earlier, the Gullah Geechee language on the coastal Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida have similarities with the Bahamian Creole language. So this shows the connection between African Americans and the Bahamas. Shout out to our brothers and sisters in the Bahamas. We love y'all.
What madness this is. How does foreign bay know Bahamian history? How come I don't know anything about this? You know, I don't even know where Adelaide is. But you know, you know, I find it fascinating and frustrating that there's a saltwater underground railroad that led to the Bahamas, and I don't know about it. And I'm no, so I went searching. I went searching and asking questions and to find out what this foreign bay talking about, you know? And then I came across, I eavesdropped between an intellectual conversation. I was listening to intellectual who named Sean McQueenie. And I listened to a Rhodes scholar who was Christopher Campbell. And they had an exchange. Sean McQueenie said that he agreed with the beginning, but that gentleman went way off and started talking foolishness about the Bahamas and our culture. And I said, what? Then Christopher Campbell, Rhodes scholar, said, we in the Bahamas are so influenced by American culture that we are quick to believe any kind of foolishness that people say about us. This is why that particular video went viral. It got my inbox 6 different times. It was spread on Facebook about 20 different times, and Bahamians got excited. We are starved for information and culture about the Bahamas. And when you find that there are people abroad who claiming to know us, who claiming to know Bahamian culture and history, of course we get vexed. I am vexed to rot it. So this is why I brought in my special guest, Christopher Davis, Chris Davis. Right, he's going to speak about one or two things that this gentleman talked about. Because I want to know what the saltwater underground railroad is, right? I want to know, he called the ship called Creole. Only Creole I know is boom. And I was going to say some couple bad words, but you know, that's all they teach you, you know? And speaking in French, that's only Creole I know. But there's a slave ship Creole that came in the Bahamas and caused almost a war. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right.
Something happened, right? On this slave ship called the Creole, right? That enslaved African people. And the Bahamas said, if you come to the Bahamas talking about locking these people up again, we will declare war. This Bahamian people saying this to them. And guess who they were going to war against? The flipping United States. Yeah. We were prepared. These were Conky Joe and blue-black Bahamians who said, these people are now free. And if you decide to come and pick them up, we plan to fight. We plan to fight. And I think that's important. That's supposed to be my part, something I should know about, right? So I'm going to ask Christopher, this may lie. Was there ever a slave ship called Creole? What happened on that, right? And how come you never tell me about the Saltwater Underground Railroad?
Good morning.
Welcome, Christopher. Christopher's a historian, by the way.
Thanks.
Where you work, by the way, Christopher?
I work at the Pompeii Museum for the Antiquities, Monuments, and Museum Corporation. I'm a researcher, historical interpreter, jack of all trades, really. But those
you must be writing a book of some sort, right?
Yeah, two books, actually. One of them, actually, both of them talk about this issue that we're speaking about right now.
Hiding our culture, hiding our history.
Hiding our culture, hiding our history, and the concept of the Saltwater Underground Railroad, which, in my view, should be expanded far beyond and involves far more profound incidences as well here in the Bahamas.
But how come this American bay, how come this American bay know about it and I don't know about it and I'm supposed to be a historian?
Well, you know, in America, there's this thirst right now for black knowledge and black history. It's starting to increase here in the Bahamas, thanks to people like yourself, you know, and others. But we still have a long way to go in terms of being in the right frame of mind and even gathering our right history, right? Because our pantheon, or what's supposed to be our pantheon of heroes, are filled by British colonial officials.
You trying to say that we have black and Conky Joe heroes and not these English like Christopher Columbus? And mind you, no, I like Christopher Columbus still.
Christopher Columbus, we could go on and on. Queen Victoria, the Duke of Windsor, a.k.a. King Edward VIII, Stafford Sands, Roland Simonet, all of these people. This is what we're left with, and we're actually deprived of some of our real heroes, right? So if you, I could start off with framing this term Saltwater Underground Railroad a little bit more accurately first. And typically, it was actually, it only referred to Seminoles, right? Mm-hmm. These Seminoles, as a matter of fact, were the predominant Maroon communities in North America and in the United States. And from 1820 or so, when Florida was ceded to the United States, these people were then rescued by your typical Bahamian sailors. You see, now, one problem that I had with the viral video is that we often give far too much credit to the British Navy, with us being a British colony. But this anti-slavery sentiment was one that was born from the enslaved themselves, and it didn't come from outside, you understand? And the Saltwater Underground Railroad actually began with the inception of the American Revolution, in my view. And Dr. Christopher Curry holds the same view as well, because this essentially is a broad term that refers to the network of people that gained their freedom in the Bahamas. So in the same way, you have the Underground Railroad that was spearheaded by the likes of Harriet Tubman, all of these black separatist preachers and even more liberal whites who helped African-Americans get north to areas like Nova Scotia, you had the same network coming down here to the Bahamas.
But wait, Chris, I even heard a story about Bahamians leading some kind of contingent to sneak black African people off the beach. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, this term of the Saltwater Underground Railroad since the American Revolution, the same way you had this network of that was spearheaded mostly by black separatist Baptist preachers and black separatist Methodist preachers, you had the same network here. So, for example, if you look at Bethel Baptist Church, that they say was founded in 1790, but I say 1784. The reason I say that was because that was when you see the first runaway ads coming out from the United States for a man named Sambo Scriven, who was the founder of that church. Furthermore,
mind you, I have some Scriven friends who looking for information about the Sambo Scriven.
Well, there you go there. They could get this right here. And I sure it's going to be recorded so they could always refer to it. Sambo Scriven is alleged to have floated over here on an open raft from St. Augustine, posing as a black loyalist, won the freedom in the slave courts of him and his wife and his children as well. But what's so powerful about this man and why he should be kind of risen to this pantheon and we could replace a Stafford Sands with him any day of the week. You understand what I'm saying? But in some of the runaway ads, you actually have the people and the militia, they're actually opining and saying, hey, make sure y'all go check that by Sambo Scriven House, because them black Baptists always known for harboring runaway slaves.
But let's talk about this war. Let's talk about this war the Bahamas was going to have against the great United States.
So from that period, and of course, there was still an adversarial relationship between Britain and the United States well into the mid 1800s, right? And remember, they had a second war known as the War of 1812. this, what was going on in the Bahamas, just exacerbated that, right? And so, of course, a lot of it was politics. It's careful to understand that this was a very nuanced thing. These rescuing of Africans in the Bahamas and African Americans, right? And the British were not all gung-ho and as anti-slavery as they would like many of us to believe. This was more to do with economics, the rivalry between
nations. You sped over something so quickly.
Yeah.
You said that there were people in the Bahamas who would have gone and rescue African Americans and bring them to the Bahamas. What do you say people? Like, describe what these color people. Who were these people?
Mostly black people, as we would describe it in the 21st
you
century.
You must be mixed up. I know black behemoths. We ain't going against no United States.
Well, let's show you how we don't know ourselves, eh? Because now we have certain stigmas towards black migrants to come to our country. Not so much from the United States, but from our Caribbean neighbors to the south. You know, we don't have to elaborate on that too much. But it was a certain time in history, particularly during the days of slavery. Those of us that were able to be free, and even some of us that were enslaved, we were the ones who were gung-ho and anti-slavery. And so you see with the case with the Creole, for example, the British Navy had very little to do with that. They were actually escorted in, and I could get a little more in depth with the entire story because it's actually
considered the most afterwards. And what are the next boats that came to the Bahamas?
Right, so you have the Peter Mowell, which is one of the more popularly known ones. A lot of work was done on it by Corey Malcolm and also Dr. Michael Pateman, our very own Bahamian archaeologist. They actually found the bolts and the screws of this ship off Lynyard Quay, which is a quay from Abaco. And this boat was owned by a man who lived in New Orleans. His name was Salvador.
We can talk about that now. And I don't want you to try to run my show and go before me. Because I still on salt water and how you're hiding the information from me.
We have an exhibit that we actually gave to the Moore Library at UB. So you could go there and see the exhibit for the Peter Mowell at UB. You could learn.
You see what you do there?
Yeah, how the people.
You see what you do there?
The people.
You just saying that you giving away my culture.
Yeah.
You're giving away my history. And that my history and my culture are in American museums. And you say my history and my culture. I'm glad you say UB. But my history and my culture is in British Museum. I watched that. What was that? What a movie was? Wakanda.
Black Panther. Right.
And I remember when
Killmonger
was inside that museum. Right? Mm-hmm. And he saw an artifact that came. This is how I feel. This is why I vex, you know? And I see Killmonger in the museum and he, in his pensive self, viewing an artifact that belongs to him, that has his culture and who he is, right?
Right.
And of course, in this particular movie, the English lady is saying, let me educate you on this thing that is a part of you, because you ain't know nothing.
Right, right.
And Killmonger got offended. And that's why I'm offended. Because I am hearing, and you can tell me if it's true or not, that there are artifacts, there are documents, there are information about the history of the Bahamas, our origins, from 1600s to present day, whatever it is, in colonial time. Mm-hmm. That is inside British museums and British libraries. And we ain't getting it because we ain't ready. You're trying to say, for people who freed African Americans, save them. Mm-hmm. You're trying to say that Bahamians aren't ready and that we cannot house
our own
stuff that we have. And I want to say this too, because I'm baiting you and I want you to respond to this.
Yeah.
There are also Lucayan bones that we found here in the Bahamas that we do not have in the Bahamas. We find it and we do not have it inside the Bahamas because it's inside the United States. How that happened, man? How are you all allowing this to happen to me?
Well, see, there's a term called the culture wars, and all of this is a part of what we call the culture wars. And a part of colonization and enslavement was, of course, this appropriation of culture, you know? And when you go in any museum, whether it's in North America, anywhere in Europe, you often find that the artifacts that are on display come from cultures that they have typically exploited and profited from said exploitation. Now, one thing I would say that's amazing to me is how some of these artifacts, in some cases, when you look at something like the Shango bone, for example, from the Congo, a mathematical artifact that's over 20,000 years old that sits in Belgium, as a matter of fact, right? And their excuse is that, of course, these nations can't house these artifacts. But this artifact is 20,000 years old, and you all had it for about 100, 150 years or so, right? So how is it that it survived for all those thousands of years? And you all only had it for this amount of time, right? So if anything, I think we would take better care of it. Now, there's even more sinister examples that I learned about from my travels to Ghana. You know, shout out Atumfo Badu Bantu, the 15th, who is the king of the Ahanta people, the same people where our very own John Kanu come from. Now, they have a case where in 1838, a man named Bonsu II, considered to be one of their last great kings. This was relayed to me by Stephen Arthur, assembly member, and my other brother, Alex Kwofi, right there from Princess Town. And they actually have this fight going on right now between the Ghanaian government, the government of Holland, and the Ahanta people, because Badu Bonsu was actually beheaded, and his head was sent to Europe for scientific, pretty much what they call scientific racism. You know, when they study the skulls of Africans to prove that they are inferior, experiments that actually backfired on them greatly in an ironic kind of way. But Badu Bonsu's head was then rediscovered in 1974, ironically near The Hague.
What?
Yeah.
How did it reach The Hague?
Huh?
How did it reach The Hague?
Because the Dutch people who was enslaving people from that area in Africa, the same Dutch people that John Kanu was fighting against, even though it was about 100 years later, they beheaded the king. He had beheaded their governor because he was slave trading his people and doing all this stuff. They had beheaded the king, sent his head to Holland. It kind of got lost for a while. And then they discovered it in a repository at the Lehman Medical Institute, at the Lehman University near The Hague in Holland. And then they didn't return it until 2009.
My God.
And it's not even, quote unquote, fully returned, you know, and it's still this argument. So that's, of course, an extreme example. One that's also related to us culturally, if you, as we get to learn more about our history, you know. So but this is something that, sorry, that's just a part of colonization, imperialism, the remnants of the notion that, you know, y'all better off with us taking care of y'all things, doing things at our behest. Because if y'all on y'all own and y'all are truly independent and autonomous, of course, things can crumble.
So you're listening to Guardian Radio 96.9. This is Guardian in the Morning. And we have one more clip. We have one more clip that I want to be played because I want Chris, my friend Chris, the historian, to respond to it. This is a adjunct professor from the United States who actually has a website about the saltwater underground railroad.
I'm very impressed with him.
This is by Stephen Morth from the United States, a Bahamian, who immigrated to the United States. So play that clip for me.
So the Saltwater Underground Railroad Experience is a Google-based virtual tour that aims to retell the stories of runaway enslaved Africans that were fleeing plantations in Georgia and South Carolina and heading to Spanish Florida in the early 1800s and also making their way across the Gulf Stream from the Florida coast to the Bahamas. So you have a hotbed of activity during that time frame where enslaved Africans were seeking freedom. And they aligned themselves with the British in many cases, aligned themselves with the Seminoles in other cases, and were really just trying to find freedom and sanctuary from chattel slavery. I came up with the idea for the site because I had been reading the work of established scholars like Dr. Keith Tinker, Dr. Rosalind Howard, Dr. Gail Saunders, and just really trying to absorb this information, much of which I had never learned in any of my classes, you know, in the Bahamas in school. So I just wanted to try to create something that any Bahamian could go to or anybody interested in American history from a Black perspective to learn about these stories, which are usually not a part of the mainstream literature. So when you talk about the Underground Railroad, most people know about the railroad that heads north into Canada, into the northern states. So I want to kind of focus this particular tour on the southern route, because it is actually the first documented underground railroad where Africans were heading into Spanish Florida. So I had been working with a national organization here in Atlanta called Outdoor Afro and visiting lots of parks in Georgia and in Florida and even in South Carolina, and just hearing about these stories of Black people fleeing plantations and trying to find freedom within these areas that are now essentially national and state parks. And I came across a few stories and it just piqued my interest in the connection between Bahamian history and Black history here in America. So one of the first articles that I read was an article by Winsboro and Netch, and they had talked about the Saltwater Railroad. And I had heard it briefly mentioned in Dr. Tinker's book, Bahamians in American History. I started going through the stories, and many of the parks that I had been visiting also kind of had bits and pieces of these stories. So I wanted to try to put them into a format that could be easily accessed. And then also, Google Earth as a powerful visual tool and a satellite imagery tool could kind of take the locations that were in these books and journals and you know, make them actually visible on the screen for people to see where these places were. And so a few interesting stories. There's one amazing story about seven Africans fleeing from Fort Jefferson, which is right on the Florida coast. Another story, of course, is well-known, the Black Seminole story, where many enslaved aligned with the Seminoles and traveled through parts of, Tampa and worked their way through all the way to Key Biscayne and, of course, headed to Andros and settled in the Red Bays area. So many people are aware of that story, but there are actually very many more stories that are out there. And so a part of the work is also trying to find those stories and trying to retell those stories. So the objective is really just awareness and opening the conversation and having people discuss these escape routes and also to have the public gain a sense of pride in the way that Africans, you know, worked so hard to achieve freedom. And so my hope also is that it strengthens the ties between African Americans, Blacks living in the United States, especially in the South, and those in the Bahamas. I mean, many of the people that we talk about, when you talk about Bahamian history, for example, there's a lot of ties between Florida, for example, and of course, the Bahamas. So learning about key figures, learning about individuals whose origins begin in Florida, is just a way to kind of build that sense of unity among Black people. And so I thought that this website would be a great way to do that.
And that was Stephen Morse, former adjunct professor at Georgia State University. He's currently a K to grade 12 science educator at Whitfield Academy in Atlanta. He's completing his PhD research focused on culturally relevant science education using public lands in the U.S. and the Caribbean. Smart guy. I need to hook you up with him in terms of his website. And the website is called, for Bahamians who want to know more about the Saltwater Underground Railroad, it's saltwaterrailroad.org. You go and visit that. It's a very interactive site. And it gives a Bahamian version of the Saltwater Underground Railroad. And this is what I'm going to ask you next, Chris. And I'm speaking with Chris Davis, who is a historian and researcher at the Pompeii Museum, who's writing his two books at one time. Yes. I mean, one is finished. He just haven't published it as yet. He is a Pan-Africanist. He tends to concentrate on Bahamian African stories. He's definitely a griot, a storyteller, and make sure that we rewrite and recorrect some of our history that is being said inside the Bahamas. So that's what I want to ask you about right now, right? African-American have a particular history, right? The Saltwater Underground Railroad is an African-American history that stops in the Bahamas, but the story does not stop there.
Right.
These same people who escaped from Florida had Bahamian lives. Yep. And I don't know what happened to them. Like the Morris family, they were on this slave ship called the Creole. Right. We have all kind of Morrises in Nassau.
Well, the Morris house, Elijah Morris, in that case with the Creole, he was actually the rowdiest and the most aggressive fellow in that thing. He fired the first shot and the last shot of that revolt. Mm-hmm. Now, when they were still in the harbor, which was actually right where Pompeii Museum is, right behind Pompeii Museum, he actually met a woman named Nancy Barton. It's not clear whether she was already here or whether she was on that ship, but she saw the swashbuckling hero named Elijah Morris, who was quite young at the time and very bold and daring, as they would say in those days. And they got married, you know, and then he had about three or four Elijah Morris that came after him. So it's like Elijah Morris the fourth or the fifth. And then it kind of fades into obscurity. But we believe that that house is right, you know, where Rhoda Bar is, right through that middle road going up the hill through Rhoda Bar. They believe it's like one of the fifth or sixth house on the left. And so all of the Morrises that come out of Gambia Village, they are descended from one of the main players, you could argue the main player, in the most successful slave revolt in United States history. And the reason it's the most successful...
I want you to repeat that.
Morrises from Gambia Village and many others all over. There are other streams of Morrises that came here, but the ones that could trace their lineage, the Gambia Village, particularly anybody named Elijah Morris, they all descended from one of the major players, you could argue the major player, in the most successful slave revolt.
Successful slave
in United States history.
You know how significant that is?
Right.
That this is a pinnacle in Black American history
right.
that culminates in the Bahamas, mm-hmm. and we don't sell that?
Right. One of the reasons, in my opinion, it's been kind of swept under the rug was actually mentioned when he mentioned the compensation, right? And so even with the Creole case, by 1853, 12 years later, they were compensated about 53,000 pounds, which is a lot of money back then, you understand, mm-hmm. For that. You understand? So again, it's important to realize that this wasn't some gung-ho anti-slavery British initiative. You know, this was business and this was politics from their perspective. But from our perspective, of course, it was freedom and justice. Right?
Excellent. Yeah. I have another clip I wanted mm-hmm. to play. But I see we have a caller here. So if we can connect that caller so we can hear him. Caller, you're on the air. This Good is morning. Guardian in the Morning.
Good morning, Cecil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, man.
JT calling in. And good morning, Chris Davis. How you doing, my friend?
I'm good, thank you.
You know, very interesting conversation that you guys are having, and I'll make it quick, my contribution. First of all, it is my understanding that the Bahamas, geographically, is not in the Caribbean. We are in the Atlantic. Further, my understanding, and I'd like for you to confirm or even correct me, sir, if I'm wrong in anything I'm saying, that you may know the facts on. I also was made to understand that the Florida Keys were once a part of the Bahamas, just as the Turks and Caicos used to once be a part of the Bahamas. So I just wanted to put those two points of information out there for either clarification or validation by you. Now, what I'm really wanting to call and say, M. Cecil, you know, one of the reasons why we do not have Bahamian history taught in our school, never had it taught, which is a crying shame to me that it was never taught, was because of the attitude of the Bahamian leadership back then, the i.e. Pinling administration. I heard with my own ears a Pinling administration participant years ago on another radio station when the issue of Bahamian history not having been taught in the schools was brought up. That particular gentleman at the time said that the reason why the Pinling administration never taught Bahamian history is because they did not want to offend the white Bahamians. Pardon?
No, go ahead. I want you to complete your thoughts.
I heard that with my own ears.
Okay.
I couldn't believe it when I heard it. For me, that with all due respect, that is stupid to even think that way, because your history is your history, and we are all a part of the history, the blacks and the whites. And a lot of Bahamians are now of the view that not all whites are racist, and not all racists are whites. There are many white Bahamians who fought for the liberation of the black masses of this country. So what the Pinning administration did, in my humble opinion, was one of the greatest insults to this country, psychologically and culturally, by refusing.
And thank you very much, JT. And actually, I hear you. Manny, I disagree with, I don't want to lambaste the Pinning administration, because they did a lot for the country, you know. And we need to appreciate that time and that era. And I hear what you're saying. But I wanted to quickly mention that the Caribbean definition is broad, and we must acknowledge that we in the Bahamas do not create definition and define such global places. The Caribbean is countries that exist in the Caribbean Sea, around the Caribbean Sea, and of the Caribbean Sea. It's also countries that is in, of, and share the same history and past in the Caribbean Basin. That means that includes the Bahamas, because of that definition. It includes Trinidad. It includes Barbados, who are also not in the Caribbean Sea. It includes Bermuda. And so when you put that official definition in place, the Bahamas is definitely a part of the Caribbean. Now, mind you, there are some non-scholars who didn't go up to grade 12 who want to change the definition from what the Caribbean is. But that is the official definition. Yes, the Bahamas is a part of the Caribbean because of that official definition. And I see Chris was eager to respond to one of the comments you made, so I let him go on.
Well, I'll start from the front coming back, you know. So I don't understand, you know, people often say they never teach us our real history, you know. What the caller needs to understand is that is no fault of the any administration since we had independence and in the years leading up before that. Reason being is, number one, something that's quite obvious and everyone knows, history is written by the winners. We just discussed a few minutes ago how Britain has appropriated this history and how that was a concerted effort, how they take all our artifacts, take all our documents and keep it for themselves. Mm-hmm. You understand? All the way leading up to that, you mentioned Daniel MacKinnon. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to mention Land of the Pink Pearl. You got to mention all of these scholars that wrote about the Bahamas, who call themselves historians, yes, coming before that, who portray a certain narrative, telling lies but Kid Island is the real San Salvador, yes, stuff like that. Yes. You understand?
Just rewriting our history right in front of us.
Thank you. Right. You see what I'm saying? So it's crazy to me. And then the fact that you bring in that, you know, racism is of all colors in the context of what we're speaking about, I don't even see how that's relevant, number one. Number two, you would have to actually make a list, and that list would be incredibly short, of people of European descent, whether it's in the Bahamas, whether it's in Haiti, whether it's in the United States, if we being truthful about history, that have, quote unquote, fought for black liberation. I don't know what he's talking about in that sense. Off the top of my head, I could think about a John Brown, mm-hmm, who led an actual slave reform.
Yes, 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 yes.
You know, people often...
His whole family.
Thank you. I could think about someone locally who, in my opinion, is no hero for black Bahamians, but I understand the nuance and I understand that he was far more liberal and that he did do some of us some favors, mm-hmm, in certain cases, and that's James Carmichael Smith.
You know, we can be round about that, right? So,
right.
You know, between Carmichael and Christopher Columbus, leave alone.
And what I see, and this is no insult to any particular person, is we have a situation of Anglophilia in this country. Pedophilia is the irrational love of underage children, uh-huh, of underage people. And Anglophilia is the irrational love of England. Yeah. And this is something that seeped into us. And the fact that people could actually mention or try to imply that any aspect of Bahamian society was better under our colonial masters, mm-hmm, than they were, you know, I don't have no time for that. You understand? Okay. And so essentially, yeah, and then on top of that, the Keys, Florida Keys, to my knowledge, were never a part of the Bahamas in the same way that Turks was. And that's another part. And then number two, beyond the official definitions, culturally and heritage-wise, we are most definitely a part of the Caribbean.
Yes. Yeah. I have another clip, and I'll just play that clip so we can conclude with mm-hmm, historian Christopher Davis, who, if you want to see him and speak to him and exchange, Pompeii Museum. Yeah. I've done that tour already, and he goes in detail. He's excited. Mm-hmm. I've learned about our past. I felt it. I tears streamed down my eyes. So I want you to go and visit him there. But play that next clip there.
In the country's history, there's been some interesting and peculiar moments in which the Bahamas became a geopolitical space for freedom. One of those moments was in 1841 when you have the incident called the Creole, where you have a ship that is destined for New Orleans with enslaved persons, that is going to eventually have a mutiny occur, led by Madison Washington and others. There were over 130 enslaved persons on that ship. They were able to overthrow the captain and the ship crew, and essentially take control of the ship. What I find fascinating about this story was they had the political acumen, the know-how, the awareness of where they were geopolitically and jurisdictionally. They understood that the British had already abolished slavery in 1834, but of course in the United States, they would not abolish slavery until 1865. So in 1841, they're able to steer the vessel into British waters in the Bahamas and actually, demand freedom being in a British territory where slavery had already been abolished. Washington and the other captives are brought into the Vice Admiralty Court, and they are in fact adjudicated as free persons. And so they are settled in Gambier. And, this story is significant because in the United States, it's seen as the most successful slave revolt, given the size and number of persons that escaped successfully to freedom in the Bahamas. And yet this story is rarely known or taught in our own country's history, unfortunately and sadly, given the fact that Gambier was settled as a liberated African community, given that you have these passengers on the Creole that eventually settled there as well. The rich African and African-American history that intersects is important. What I note, however, in the Creole incident is often the story is told through the lens of U.S. history and sort of a U.S. Jingoistic narrative. And that's unfortunate that it doesn't get told from the Bahamian narrative perspective. And that's because it's really not considered as essential part of the narrative on slave resistance and freedom in the Bahamas. It's an awkward story, I suppose, because it happens after 1838 when full emancipation occurs. And even the discussion of liberated Africans is a complicated one that requires nuance. For all of these reasons, it is often neglected in our curriculum and neglected in the teaching in our school system. I would advance that we need to include these important stories to enhance and enrich the Bahamian curriculum and not rely solely on the US perspective on these things. The journey from the United States into the Bahamas and the Creole is an important one, but it has to be told either through a transnational lens where we look at border states and regions that are ambiguously defined, or you tell the story from the transnational perspective where you include both the US and the Bahamian story, because the story certainly didn't end when they entered Bahamian waters, nor when they were adjudicated. The story must extend to their lived experiences in Gambier. So this is just one of the problematic issues we have in our curriculum and the way we teach our history. And so we need to do a better job of nuancing these kind of stories, liberated Africans, the Creole incident. And there's even another story, the Peter Morrell, which is another incident that is uncomfortably told because of its location in the mid 19th century, where you have a ship that is wrecked off of Abaco, and black sailors and some whites actually assist these persons in struggling ashore and surviving. And again, that's another complicated story that doesn't get told. So these things need to be discussed thoroughly and systematically, not as peripheral stories, but as centerpieces to a more complex and nuanced history.
Chris, I only get 7 more minutes. This is what happens when they only give you 1 hour show and they put commercials in and it's only 45 minutes. But I have a caller, so I'm going to have the caller speak for that 30 seconds. Okay. And I want you to talk about the Peter Morrell before you go.
Yes, sir.
Okay, go ahead, caller.
Hi, CA?
This is CA. Go ahead.
Yeah, morning and morning to your guests. Listen, I just, I taught Stefan in at NC 30 years ago, right?
Yes.
So I want to apologize to Stefan, but I could only teach what I know, right?
Right.
And so, we were given a syllabus,
right,
and we taught for results. So,
exactly.
You taught what was necessary for your students to get the
right.
best.
I understand.
Exactly.
The best result.
Right.
Another thing, right? There are oral, there are oral history. And there's also the written history. And so, you have there were many stories going around, but unless you had the documentation or something to prove that these things were actually, you know, legitimate, you could not really, you know, speak to those things. So like the gentleman said, we need a more, our curriculum should be, now that we have the BGCSE, should more be focused on Bahamian, really Bahamian history, because there are a lot of, I'm going right now. Right now on the USA, they are talking about America's hidden history, right? And they talk about how many blacks from 1776 and beyond were very instrumental in the building of the U.S., but these things are not told. And it's the same thing with our Bahamian history. Right. There's a lot of hidden Bahamian history things that we don't even know. Like I told Vaughn the other day that I didn't know that Flowers was the first really man of color to fly Boeing 707. I didn't know that. You see, so there are a lot of things that we didn't know, and I taught history like 30 years ago, and you taught what was in the book, and that is what we had. Thanks for your time, buddy.
Yes, thanks sir. Very much. Thank you. Yes, I see I ran out of time, and I had one or two more clips by Dr. Christopher Curry. I'll just WhatsApp that to around the world, let people appreciate it, because it's some good information. Yeah. Oh, but yeah. I want to hear about the Peter Morrell.
Yeah, so the Peter Morrell, as I was saying earlier, was owned by a man named Salvador Pratt, no relation to the Pratts here. The ship actually stole people from the Congo River region. Okay, it was about 400 people, the vast majority of whom were children. And the ship actually wrecked on November 11th, 1860, on Lynyard Quay, one of the keys off the eastern side of Abaco. They were stuck there for 3 days, and the quay had no food, no water, because nobody lived there at the time. Of course, the narrative of the story focuses on William Sweeting and Ridley Pinder, as these kind of swashbuckling wreckers who rescued these slaves who refused an offer of £40,000, a bribe that was given to them by the enslaver or the captain of the ship, Alex Smith. Okay, now these people from Congo, from the Congo River, many of them ended up in two places, Congo Town in Southern Andres, and they also ended up in Congo Town in Fox Hill. They actually built St. Paul's Native Baptist Church right there on Bernard Road, okay? So this is something we could touch and feel. And many of the Harveys who come out of Eastern New Providence actually descend from these people. Some people have erroneously claimed that liberated Africans willingly adopted these British surnames. That's not true. They were just trying to conform to a society where, to this day, as a matter of fact, certain aspects of African custom are illegal. And a big part of that was, of course, changing your name. And, of course, many of these people, especially those who ended up staying here and who were apprenticed to the mostly white Bahamian families, you can't be living as an apprentice for 7 to 14 years under the roof or in the yard of someone who was formerly of the Bahamian planter class, and you're talking about I from Africa and I worship this God that ain't Jesus and all of that. So again, this term liberated African is one that's quite nuanced, and I personally don't use it to refer to those ships that came directly from Africa. But again, the nuance is important, because even on the Peter Morrell, for example, say you had somebody who got captured after war when their entire village was wiped out, you know, but then you have another person who is living their life peacefully and free, and they just happen to get snatched one day and put on the slave ship to come here. And then you have one of them that gets sentenced to 14 years apprenticeship. And many of these children actually ended up raking salt in Inagua, raking salt in all of the places where salt was typically produced in the Bahamas. Very similar to how it would have been during the days of slavery, right? Then you have Abul Kelly, even, who mentioned that when he doesn't do work, he's whipped by a cream-faced man. And many of these liberated Africans suffered some of the same things they would have in chattel slavery even after 1838.
Excellent. Christopher, I appreciate you coming on the show, especially last minute. I appreciate Christopher Curry, Dr. Christopher Curry, sending you, because you know he was going to be the first one to come on the show.
Yes, and he sent me in his stead.
Yes, you know? And I appreciate it. Yeah. You definitely a good substitute. This has been Guardian in the AM. My name is C.A. Nuri, and there's so much of our history and culture that somebody's hiding from me. I want to know it. I am begging that they give it to me. And if it's not taught inside the schools, They need to create other places where I can get this information from. I'm hoping that Fox Hill open up their own museum. I'm hoping that Adelaide open up their own museum. And I'm hoping that Gambia have decided, the people there, to open up their own venue that I can learn about what happened there. Again, this is Guardian in the AM. My name is C.A. Nuri, and I'm holding on. I'm holding on for 3 shows. Next week will be the last one. Good day.